In our appetite for easy stories, we have this tendency to mischaracterize how great inventions happen. We say Thomas Edison invented the light bulb without acknowledging the many other creators experimenting in that space, not to mention the fact that Edison employed a whole campus of brilliant engineers to help perfect his ideas and bring them to fruition. And the same way we oversimplify stories of people we admire, we do the same thing with people we despise, people responsible for extraordinary suffering and destruction. Hitler, acting alone, could not have carried off the Holocaust. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Co-conspirators to evil don't inspire the same fear and loathing as the masterminds, but my guest argues we should be paying attention and demanding accountability and working to build cultures in organizations and societies that reward us for speaking up about misdeeds, not for turning a blind eye or lending a hand. Max H. Baserman is the Jesse Isidore Strauss Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. His book is called Complicit: How We Enable the Unethical and How to Stop. Max, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about complicity.
Well, I'm excited as well. The book really examines the ways the worst events in human history have been either allowed or assisted by those other than the ones who made the decision to cause harm. What do we miss when we only blame the people in charge?
We miss the opportunity to avoid future disasters by failing to realize the role that all of us have to play in order to keep wrongdoers from perpetuating their harm. Basically, we will always be confronted with people who do things that we find unacceptable. But the problem is that my research, which is documented in Complicit, shows that in every single case I can come up with, the evildoer that we read about in the newspaper is surrounded by dozens, if not more, complicitors who enable them to get away with their harm. And if these complicitors did not sit by and allow the evil to happen, the evil, in fact, could not have developed to the level that it did.
I was thinking about the fact that we actually know this without acknowledging it to ourselves, right? It's what makes it so hard for people to believe, for example, that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. It's so rare for somebody to carry off some terrible thing all by themselves.
Exactly right. And when we look at sort of events that exist in large organizations, it becomes impossible for the evildoers to create their harm by themselves. There are always people around them. So whether we look at the Holocaust, as you opened with, or the January 6th, 2021 insurrection, or you can pick your favorite miniseries about a recent scandal, what we find is that the harm doer could not have acted alone. They needed complicitors. And unfortunately, we too often comply with their need for complicitors.
Before we talk more about some of these examples, Max, what do we need to know about your definition of complicity for purposes of this discussion?
Great question. Thank you, Chris. I see a complicitor as somebody who knowingly allows the harm to occur. So it need not be an illegal action. It need not be an action that we would look at and say, this makes you a terrible person. It's simply an action or a set of inactions that allows the harm to develop. And typically what I find is that people don't want to be as complicit as they end up being. So if we can get people to deliberate and to think more, they're more likely to take action that prevents the harm from happening.
So let's start with the most egregious actors, short of the ones who are giving the direct orders. These are the people you call true partners. If the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma, their company, can be blamed for sort of coming up with this scheme that ignited the opioid crisis, who were the true partners that made it possible for Purdue to earn billions from getting people hooked on drugs?
Right. So first of all, within the organization Purdue Pharmaceutical, there were a number of executives who actively participated in the harm, and three of them were in fact indicted for mismarketing the products, which resulted in the deaths of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people. So often there are employees within the organization who knowingly go along for the same purpose. But we also see organizations outside the core organization. So, for example, Purdue had McKinsey, the famous consulting firm, advising them on how to turbocharge their sales, including how to get patients to take larger dosages that were even more likely to be addicting. And McKinsey did this while at the same time earning over $20 million from the FDA, from the U.S. government FDA, for advice on how to better regulate pharma. So they were both sort of advising Purdue about how to get away with this evil while they were advising the government about how to stop such ill behavior. And evidence suggests that they did not properly reveal their conflicts of interest along the way.
And in addition to that double dipping, you note that the folks at McKinsey sort of hold up both hands, palms out, and say, listen, all we do is make recommendations. We don't tell anybody, or not even make recommendations, but they present scenarios. They're not telling anybody what to do. That feels like a flimsy defense in the aftermath, doesn't it?
Very flimsy. So, and McKinsey often does this. They give advice that leads to true harm, and then they basically say, but we only give advice. We don't make the final decision. That's up to the executives and the companies we advise. Yet we also know that McKinsey and the opioid story has paid a $573 million settlement to 47 states. So they're denying any wrongdoing, yet they're willing to pay over $500 million as a result of their actions.
So in the Holocaust, beyond Hitler and the loyal members of the Nazi Party, the leaders of Vichy France got right on board with Nazi persecution and set about rounding up their own citizens to deport to concentration camps. This is an illustration of how true partners are not necessarily the masterminds, but their core values align, or lack of values, align with the values of the instigators, right?
And I think that that's right. There was an enormous amount of anti-Semitism that existed throughout Europe at the point that the Holocaust was occurring. And not only the Vichy government in France, but a number of the Eastern European countries that Hitler invaded, including Poland and Ukraine and Lithuania and Latvia, he found sort of partners who were happy to help him in his development of the Holocaust.
What is the distinction between a true partner, some of the examples we've just talked about, and the people you call collaborators?
They're similar. They're both intentional. But true partners want the same outcome as the core harm doer, whereas collaborators basically work along with the evildoer, but their goal is something different. So, for example, if we think about the Volkswagen Dieselgate scandal, where Volkswagen intentionally deceived the public about their diesel engines and created enormous amounts of pollution, resulting in the deaths of tens of thousands of unknown people. The unions went along with them because they wanted to protect the jobs in the Volkswagen factories. And the Lower Saxony government, which was a home to Volkswagen, basically wanted an environment where there was full employment in their community. So we often see people who want different things and knowingly go along. We also see that in terms of the WeWork events, where, you know, basically Adam Neumann was misinforming lots of people along the way as he developed WeWork. And there's good evidence that Benchmark, which was a leading venture capital firm, invested in WeWork early on, had a good idea what was going on, and yet did too little to protect other parties that might be harmed.
So all these folks, including WeWork's board of directors, should have recognized there were dark clouds on the horizon, that this was never going to scale up and be financially sustainable. But as long as the stock's value stayed artificially high, they were raking in money, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, at the point of the story, WeWork is privately held, and basically Benchmark is trying to keep things as quiet as possible, hoping that the company can go public and they can sell as much of their stock as they possibly can.
When it comes to alleged wrongdoing by former President Trump, you call Steve Bannon a true partner, but put Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell in the collaborator category. Is that because they didn't necessarily agree with the president's disregard for democracy, his support of white supremacist ideas, but they saw that showing him public support would get them what they wanted?
Exactly. True partners are aligned on core values. And I think Bannon was quite aligned with Trump in terms of tolerance for white supremacy and willing to destroy democracy. I don't think that McConnell or Graham had those values, but they so wanted to load the Supreme Court with political allies that they were willing to go along with Trump to get what they wanted in return for their support for the truly evil values that much of the Trump administration represented.
Max, all of us want to think of ourselves as good people, and we have plenty of ways to sort of lie to ourselves when we diverge from that. But how do you think it happens that people who are not true partners but are instead collaborators are able to manage the cognitive dissonance of supporting something that they, in their heart of hearts, must know is not right with their desire to get what they want?
I think that we often are blinded by a narrow set of interests. We're focusing on, I could easily imagine that McConnell and Graham honestly believe the world is better off with right-leaning Supreme Court judges. And they're so obsessed with that that they put on blinders and accept sort of core evil at levels that they wouldn't intentionally want to accept. Similarly, when the unions are protecting jobs, they think that's their job to protect jobs. And when they overlook the fraud that Volkswagen is perpetrating on society, it's simply out of focus. My colleague Ann Tenbrunsel at Notre Dame uses the term ethical fading to talk about how when we're obsessed with some set of concerns, other parts of the story can easily fade from our awareness.
Yeah, it really speaks to the fact that although we are excited about goals and we think they're very important, we need to be careful along the way that we're not losing sight of who we are.
Absolutely. And I think it's a whole lot easier to do this before we're sort of in the midst of a scandal, to think about what are our core values, when would we speak up, when would we not go along, when would we not take advantage of the position that we're in, because we're helping harm occur at a level that's truly unacceptable.
That's interesting. So we need to make like an if-then plan in the same way that people who are trying to stick to a diet or stay sober do.
Absolutely. And we might want to even tell our colleagues about what our plans are and have a common front about what kinds of activities we would find unacceptable so that we have a social support system that allows us to commit ourselves to the plans that we make about stopping evil from happening in our organizations.
Max, many of us might find it hard to relate to the true partners or collaborators we talked about. But then in part two of the book, you shift to more ordinary forms of complicity. And in this section, we come upon some scenarios that might hit a lot of us uncomfortably close to home. For those of us who didn't listen to the podcast Nice White Parents, which was a true story, can you give us a quick summary of what was at stake?
Sure. So Nice White Parents is a NPR podcast, which I found quite fascinating. And the story talks about liberal parents in New York City who basically influence the school board in ways that at one level are generous in terms of fundraising for the school, but in another way end up being self-serving for the interests that tilt toward what's preferred for the children of wealthy white individuals. And Hannah Jaffe, I'm blocking on
Walt,
her last name.
Jaffe Walt.
Walt, yeah, does a kind of a terrific job of showing how perfectly nice people can create discriminatory systems without their intention. And they're kind of privileged to basically control the school board system allows them to put into place programs that will benefit their children at the expense of lots of other people. And what makes the story so fascinating, and it ties to what you said just a minute or two ago, is it's not a story about sort of evildoers in the sense of being true partners or intentional collaborators, but people who were undoubtedly trying to do what they thought was good, to enhance the quality of the school. But they want to enhance the quality of the school from the perspective of what would benefit their kids rather than the broader set of kids that exist at the school. And so often, when we're in positions of privilege, it leads us to engage in behavior where we kind of accept our privilege and we continue to benefit from our privilege rather than seeking to enhance the overall society or school or government that we're a participant in.
I appreciated that you shared a story here in which you had never really questioned why professors in business schools like you are frequently paid a whole lot more than professors in, say, the School of Psychology or certain arts. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I was giving a talk at Stanford University, and my host for the talk was one of the world's great social psychologists, a gentleman by the name of Lee Ross. Lee Ross passed away about a year ago, but he was an eminent social psychologist, and my talk was on social comparison processes. And as he introduced me to give my talk, he kind of said offhand, and hopefully, Max, during your talk, you'll explain why business school professors get paid so much more than psychology professors. And what he was representing was a true fact that business school professors in the US, not in all countries, are paid far better than professors in the social sciences. And this is partially based on sort of the demand for the services and the wealth of the schools and their ability to pay. But Lee kind of continued on this theme with a question in the middle of the talk, and he mentioned it at the close of the talk. And that evening, when we're in a smaller group talking about the research connected to the talk, he finally says, "You know, Max, what's really annoying me is that you're not even bothered by the inequity of the pay system in American universities." And I'm sure that you have lots of listeners who think, well, supply and demand determines things, and so that's fair. And I could easily justify why I had been paid what I had been paid. But Lee was right. I hadn't even given much consideration to the inequality of the pay among very similar scholars across different colleges of our universities. And this phenomena of people who are in positions of privilege don't typically appreciate the degree to which privilege benefits them, while people who are on the downside of the comparison can easily obsess kind of a great deal. And we're not going to resolve the question of should business school professors get paid more than psychology professors in our conversation today. But I think it's at least useful for those of us who are in positions of privilege, and that's probably virtually all of your listeners, to at least consider the degree to which they benefit from privilege and the possibility that their privilege is what's keeping them from speaking up and creating a more equitable society.
And boy, these things can really sneak up on us when we don't necessarily hold any intention to act in biased ways. So I'm thinking of, a number of years ago, there were a lot of people looking at the Oscar so white phenomenon and why, actors and directors and technicians of color very seldom won. You give the example of like academic awards that in which typically people who have won the awards in the past are asked to judge the next year's competition, and they look around and the pool of people they're considering are often people they know or people they work with or people who are like them in some way. So they're not necessarily deliberately excluding whole categories of scholars in this case, but it can happen unless people are paying attention and working hard not to allow it.
That's a terrific summary. And so the story that I tell in the book is about a group called the Academy of Management Fellows, which are 200 recognized leaders in the academic area of management. And There has long been a process where the fellows, and I'm one of them, is allowed to nominate zero or one individual each year for consideration for membership as a fellow. And when you allow people to nominate up to one person, they most commonly think about someone around them. And unfortunately, white guys are surrounded by more white guys than any other demographic group. And that can easily lead to a discriminatory policy. When I brought this up to the leadership of the Academy of Management Fellows, it led to a series of conversations, and the vast majority of fellows who spoke up in any way whatsoever basically said, yep, we have a problem here and we need to fix it. And we need to figure out how do we create a better nominating system. And that's occurred in a relatively short period of time. It wasn't that the group was against doing anything. It's simply that we kind of were all doing just fine with the existing system, and therefore we allowed it to occur. Once people were aware of the issue, they were all in favor of reform and coming up with a system that would be less discriminatory moving forward.
How do charismatic leaders end up influencing followers or subordinates to imitate their behavior without really questioning whether something is actually right or wrong?
Yeah, so we used to think of false prophets as people like Jim Jones, who led the People's Temple and led his followers to, quote unquote, drink the Kool-Aid, even though it was Flavor-Aid, not Kool-Aid, that they drank. And so we think of religious figures or cult leaders as people who become false prophets. But we now see a bunch of false prophets emerging in the corporate world. So certainly Elizabeth Holmes and Adam Newman fit this portrayal. And in the last few weeks, we've run into Sam Bankman-Fried, and where we've seen the collapse of the FTX crypto exchange occur. In all these cases, these false prophets convince people that the world has changed in a fundamental way and the old rules don't apply. And if you even question who I am or the wisdom of my thoughts, you're not being loyal and you don't belong in this organization. So Elizabeth Holmes was famous for basically firing any employee who didn't drink the Kool-Aid, essentially, and have a belief in her fraudulent technology. And similarly, Adam Newman talked about how it's a new economy where profit doesn't matter. All that matters is growth. And the old rules no longer apply. It's a paradigm shift. I think when we hear corporate leaders telling us that there's a paradigm shift and the old rules no longer apply, we need to be skeptical rather than think we need to jump in and become part of this new capitalist movement.
So Elizabeth Holmes was just sentenced to, I think, 11 years in prison for her part in that fraud. She is appealing, but it seems likely that she will do some time and be held accountable. In that case, in the Theranos case, how did Walgreens, as corporate partner of Theranos, how did its failure to do due diligence before teaming up with Theranos amount to a kind of complicity?
Terrific question. So I think the two amazing stories about following a false prophet are both the board at Theranos, who kind of just followed Elizabeth Holmes rather than providing due diligence, but also Walgreens, the pharmacy organization that basically brought Theranos technology into their pharmacies and administered blood testing technology that simply didn't work as it was promised. And the documentation of the Walgreens role is that Walgreens was obsessed with getting the Theranos technology before CVS did. And in their competition with CVS, they basically turned a blind eye to the fact that Holmes and Theranos more broadly refused to provide the basic information that a joint venture partner should expect. Walgreens even had a consultant who I document in the book who kept on warning Walgreens that there's something wrong here, that Theranos is simply avoiding providing evidence that they would provide If in fact the technology was as credible as they claim. So Walgreens kind of turns a blind eye. They focus on how do we get the deal done? How do we beat CVS? And in the process, they administered fraudulent tests on their patients. And I think that they're very culpable for the harm that they created.
Max, you also write here about former, I guess you can call him Hollywood kingmaker, Harvey Weinstein, the producer who was finally convicted of rape in 2020, but had been allegedly assaulting women since at least the 1970s. The thing about this that is so awful is that it was no kind of secret. It was kind of well known throughout Hollywood. And Weinstein committed his crimes with help. Who were some of the figures? We don't normally think of sexual assault as something that has lots of people involved, but there was a circle of complicity that protected Weinstein, wasn't there?
Stunning. So executives within his organization, his assistants who would basically deliver his victims to his hotel room, the agents of aspiring actors, producers that he worked with, basically all knew things were wrong and looked the other way because Weinstein was a very powerful person and their own careers could benefit by basically keeping as silent as possible. So we often see this sort of deference to authority and in ways that allow allow leaders to act in harmful ways. And too many people remain silent as that happens.
How did the Weinstein affair help keep a lid on similar allegations against Matt Lauer, the former NBC anchor?
Yeah, so I think so often when the dam breaks and people come forward, and the New York Times played a critical role with two female reporters who basically broke the story. Once the sort of dam broke on the Weinstein story, then lots of other people move forward with similar accusations against lots of other visible figures in the media world as well. So once people see it as a possibility to speak out, they're much more willing to do so. And I think that that's an important part of the story.
But there were threats, right, by the Weinstein company that if NBC carried this story, the Weinsteins would tell Matt Lauer stories.
Absolutely. And so Weinstein was willing to do anything possible to keep the story quiet. But as the Weinstein story, once the Weinstein story is breaking anyhow, then Matt Lauer and lots of other people basically fall with him.
All of this should make us think about the fact that we tend to consider loyalty like an unalloyed good, but loyalty to the wrong person is only going to perpetuate harm.
Exactly right. And so I have a chapter on authority and loyalty. And we can think of Harvey Weinstein as an authority figure, but we also see loyalty to organizations. So whether it's sort of the rape of children at Penn State or Michigan State or the child abuse that occurred within the Catholic Church, lots of people knew what was going on, but remained quiet because of their loyalty to the organization. So it wasn't loyalty to the perpetrator. As was the case in the Harvey Weinstein episode, but it was loyalty to this organization that sort of threatening it in any way was more important than preventing the future rape of additional children. And that's very, very sad and unfortunate.
It also speaks to the importance of whistleblower protections, right? Because so often the people who know about these things that are able to speak out have the most to lose, as opposed to the people who have been protected by these organizations.
Exactly. We want to think about how do we create more opportunity for whistleblowing. We want to create more opportunity for people to report the story without fear of bad things happening to them. We want to change the culture within organizations so speaking out about wrongdoing is viewed as a good thing rather than making you a troublemaker. So there's lots of things that leaders can do to create an environment where people are less complicit. And once people are less complicit, the harm doers are less likely to perpetuate their evil.
Max, what is the blue wall of silence?
The blue wall of silence refers to an informal role, not a formal role, but an informal role within the police force, that you basically don't rat out your fellow police officer. And this has allowed police officers, it has allowed evildoers within the police force to get away with their harm while their partners and other police officers around them would not report them. And this has allowed bad things to happen, particularly to underrepresented communities for far, far too long.
I'm not excusing the behavior, but it is understandable how it happens, right? These are presumably men and women who know each other quite well, who have served together in really stressful situations. Now, their ultimate loyalty is supposed to be to the populations of civilians that they have sworn themselves to protect and defend. But it's understandable that their loyalties feel divided. What can we do in these cases where it's sort of natural to feel a particular pull toward the group rather than the people that we're supposed to be taking care of?
Well, we do some things. So more police officers are required to wear cameras to record the events that are taking place. But we can also pass laws that create responsibility on police officers to not act in complicit ways when other police officers around them are acting in truly inappropriate ways. So I think we can pass laws, we can enforce laws, we can hold the complicit officers accountable, and we're beginning to see that happen in society. We simply have waited far too long to move in that direction.
Some companies note their use of independent auditors as a hedge against unethical behavior, but you note something I had not considered before, which is that independent auditors stand to lose a client if they blow the whistle too hard on bad behavior. There's like a built-in conflict of interest within what ought to be a somewhat adversarial relationship.
Terrific summary, Chris. So let me back up and just kind of highlight that in the U.S. and in all developed economies, we have a system in place where corporations are required to be audited by a quote-unquote independent auditor. And the idea is to allow other parties to look at the books of the firm and to be able to have confidence in them because they've been validated by this independent auditor. The only problem is we haven't created an independent auditing system because companies hire their auditors and they can fire them if they don't like what the auditor has to say. We've allowed auditors to get into the business of selling consulting services to the same clients, and they can make more money by selling consulting services. And we also see a pattern where when auditors leave the audit firm for another job, where do they go? The answer is they frequently go to one of the clients that they've audited in the past. And when you put these together, it's a little bit like asking a parent to be an independent auditor to assess the intelligence of their child. a mother or a father is simply not capable of giving you an objective assessment of the attractiveness or intelligence or the potential of their children. We're biased to see the world in the way we want to see it, and that's true of auditors. The auditing industry is in dramatic need of massive reform. But the final four audit firms, the four large audit firms that dominate the business for large American corporations, continue to lobby to prevent us from getting to a point where we should have any reason to trust these firms to any degree at all.
Assuming those firms are not set up with the intention of, defrauding investors and letting companies get away with malfeasance, why would they fight so hard against reforms, do you think?
Because it would reduce their profit. Hmm. If they couldn't sell consulting services to the same client, they would not be as well off. If they couldn't keep the client on an ongoing basis, they would lose profitability. So these firms benefit from a system by which they have an incentive to please their clients. And I think that that's exactly what they do. And that's also why we often see a scandal occur And then we see a subsequent story about sort of the lawsuit against the audit firm for neglecting to do their job the way that they should have been doing it. The problem is that our audit firms just aren't looking hard enough to see wrongdoing, and that allows scandals to perpetuate.
How does it happen that becoming really familiar with one scandal, even one that is quite egregious, in lots of different fronts, in politics, in business, in private life, how does that sort of attenuate us to that scandal and make us less sensitive to the next one to come along that may be even worse?
Yeah, so I think that once we see an industry corrupted, it almost seems normal. So if we think about the insurance industry, lots of consumers who have filed complaints have noticed that the insurance company doesn't simply pay the fair value of the claim, but they fight it and try to pay less than the fair value of the claim. How did this ever happen? And why do we think of this as normal? And the history of this goes is documented in a book by Jay Feinman, Dispute, Defend. And what Feinman documents is that McKinsey was a consultant to Allstate about 35 years ago, and basically convinced Allstate that the best way to improve the profitability of the insurance firm was to treat the claims department as a profit center. So rather than having professionals who had a legal and moral obligation to pay what was fair, the idea was we can make a lot more money if we simply pay out less in claims. And in the process, McKinsey sold Allstate an alternative system that normalized this idea of insurance companies haggling to pay as little as they can rather than paying what they were morally obligated to pay. Unfortunately, other insurance companies saw that this was profitable for Allstate and moved in the same direction, often with McKinsey's advice. So we see kind of this domain that as of 1980, we thought that a claims adjuster was trying to pay the fair value, move to a system where we almost view it as normal that an insurance company is trying to pay as little as they possibly can.
You know, I mean, it's not surprising that so many of us have a very cynical attitude toward corporations these days, given what we know, what's been reported. But I wonder if in some ways our cynicism that says, well, they're all the same, actually allows more of that behavior to continue. The corporations realize we think they're doing this stuff anyway, and they can probably get away with it for exactly that reason.
I think you have it right on target. I think that this kind of blanket cynicism is dysfunctional. I don't mean to encourage people to think the corporations are bad. I think that we want to look hard at the specific behaviors of different corporations and to hold those who are doing wrong truly accountable. But I don't think we want to create a blanket accusation and assume that all corporations are involved in evil.
What does it take to build cultures within any organization that allow people to look out for one another without going so far as to enable or even encourage abuses by members of those groups?
Yeah, so I think that leaders play a key role. I mean, I think that when leaders are cynical about ethical behavior, when leaders are engaged in unethical behavior, they create norms around them. In contrast, when leaders sort of create systems that basically say, we're going to protect the whistleblower, we want people to do what's right rather than simply what's profitable, they can create a truly, truly different environment. One of my consulting clients created a video of four senior executives, each of whom tells a story about when they went above their boss's head in that organization because their boss was doing something that was wrong. And by creating the video, this corporation is celebrating the idea that we reward proper behavior rather than simply complying with authority or going after short-term profits. And so I think our leaders can do so much to create the environment in which people want to and actually do engage in ethical behavior.
Max, this book also made me think a lot about the relentless goal setting that most companies and other organizations engage in. I mean, that's the way we think of ourselves as moving forward and coming up with bigger, better, faster, more ideas for things. How can goal setting unintentionally encourage unethical behavior?
Sure. Well, we can start with an example. So Wells Fargo basically developed their scandal by creating goals for employees in their branch offices to sell customers more and more products that their customers were harmed by. And they did it by creating goals and making it the norm that if you don't sell X number of products per customer, your job is in danger and your opportunities for promotion basically don't exist. So they created goals that their employees could only meet through unethical behavior, and unethical behavior is exactly what they got as a result. And we're all around organizations that set goals. And I don't mean to imply goals are bad, but I do mean to say that they need to be used with care, because when we set particularly high goals on one dimension of performance, we often get lower performance on other dimensions. So if you pay people based on the number of units they produce, you can expect quality to go down. If you tell people if you don't reach a particular level, and reaching that level requires unethical behavior, you're going to get more unethical behavior. So I think when leaders pursue goal setting strategies, they need to be aware of the likely behavior that's going to follow as a result of those goals.
And it sounds like we need to be constantly calibrating those goals, right? So if we're looking for volume, we need to say we're only looking for an increase in volume if quality doesn't go down, or that sort of thing.
Exactly. Or come up with a better and broader metric that captures everything that we're looking to obtain.
You write in the book, and I think it's interesting, that you don't feel like an especially loyal person to organizations. I mean, like, you're loyal to your family and your closest friends, but you don't necessarily feel an obligation to spout the company line. Lots of other people don't feel that way. What can we do to sort of grow a streak within ourselves that allows us to be a little bit to rebel against company goals that we have come to believe are our goals?
Yeah. So first, I do want to clarify. I want to help my organization, Harvard University, achieve excellence in terms of research and teaching. But I want to do that because I think that that's good for the broader society. And if there are situations where inappropriate behavior is occurring within the organization, I view it as my moral obligation to speak out rather than to go along with behavior that I think is inappropriate. Peter Singer wrote a book about enlarging circles. And what he argues in enlarging circles is as we move from our family to our community to the broader society, as we enlarge our circle of people that we're concerned with, we're more likely to engage in more ethical behavior. So as a professor of a fine university that's doing lots of good in the world, I could limit my focus to my department or the Harvard Business School or Harvard University more broadly, but I hope that I focus more broadly on how to improve research and teaching in the world, how to create a broader society. So the broader the circle of influence, I think the more good I can help create in the world. And it's in that sense that I don't focus on loyalty at a low level, at a smaller circle. I want to think about the broadest circle I possibly can.
Max H. Baserman is the Jesse Isidore Strauss Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. His book is called Complicit: How We Enable the Unethical and How to Stop. Max, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. You've been a terrific interviewer, and I appreciate you knowing so much about my book and creating a terrific conversation. I really appreciate your input.
Thank you. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think. We hope that you will subscribe to our podcast and sign up for our free e-newsletter. You can find that at our website, think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.